May I have your attention, please? The following is not the real Jeff Foxworthy.
If you think it's your fault every time you get stung by a bee, you might be a beekeeper. If when robbing is going on at your house, but you don't call the police, well, you might be a beekeeper. If you have enough beeswax lip balm to last your family for 300 years, you might be a beekeeper.
Welcome, welcome to Bee Love Beekeeping, presented by our great friends over at Man Lake. Today's episode is going to be completely dedicated to apitherapy, or the use of honeybee products for medicinal or health benefits. Our guest is Ross Conrad, who's a New England beekeeper and extremely knowledgeable on the topic. This is a longer discussion than usual, so we're going to jump right in after we give a quick but hearty thank you to Vita Bee Health for their support of this podcast. Vita's Varroa Control range of products includes Apistan, Apiguard, and now Varroxan, extended-release oxalic acid strips. Thanks, guys. Now, all things apitherapy. We have with us today Ross Conrad, coming to us all the way from Vermont. And Ross, good morning. How are you?
Good morning, Eric. Doing well. Thank you.
It is great that we could finally connect. And just to let our listeners know, we're going to be talking about a cool subject today, which is apitherapy, something that you know a lot of. But first, let's find out who Ross is and what are you doing in Vermont and what's beekeeping like there. So jump right in anywhere.
I started beekeeping by working with some local commercial beekeepers, Bill and Charlie Mraz. And Charlie Mraz is a world famous beekeeper. Between the two of them, they were father and son. They had over 100 years of beekeeping experience. That's how I got my education. And Charlie Mraz was known as the father of apitherapy, who first actually brought the use of bee products and bee venom to the United States and really pushed hard to try to get the medical establishment interested in the benefits of bee venom therapy and apitherapy in general. Beekeeping in Vermont is great. I'm in the Champlain Valley, which is the best place to keep bees in all of New England. Been a little bit more challenging of recent years, but haven't given up. I keep working at it, hopefully beating the odds.
Good.
Pretty tough. I don't know if you heard recently, this past 9 months, had one of the biggest die off. They're estimating well over 1 million colonies of bees died just in the last 9 months here in the United States.
Yeah, we have talked all about it on this podcast. Had Chris Hyatt on a couple of episodes ago to give us a good explanation. And we're waiting like everybody else to see what the cause is. Nobody really knows yet.
Well, it's interesting for me. This winter had really mixed results. I had some bee yards. I lost really high, 46, 55, 100% of my bees died. And other bee yards, well, I lost none or had less than 10% loss. And so it strikes me that, you know, if it was something that beekeepers were doing or myself, you know, because I treat all my hives the same, I manage them all the same. So if it was something that I was doing wrong or not doing, then I would expect to see more consistent losses in all my bee yards. But the fact that some of them get hit hard and some of them don't at all tells me that it's something outside the bee yard that's affecting them.
And do you have any speculation on what that might be?
Oh, of course. Everyone's got speculation, but
we're doing a sweepstakes here. Whoever gets it right wins. So go ahead and put your 2 cents in.
Well, unfortunately, I believe it probably, if not partially, if not wholly, responsible is the pesticides and the inadequate regulation of pesticides that goes on in the United States, especially. And that now that they're also finding that a lot of the forever chemicals, the PFAS and stuff, are in the pesticides as well.
Yeah.
And the bees are being exposed, and we know it harms them.
The neonics are a big problem because they're systemic and you can't prevent the bees from being exposed, and bee farmers are using them even when they don't even have a pest problem. I got a feeling that that's it, but you know, I'm holding back and waiting for the results. I know there's over a dozen researchers all taking samples and looking into this to try to figure out what's going on. So I'll be looking forward to seeing the results.
Yeah, me too. And I love that you brought all of that up about the chemicals and the forever chemicals. And whether that explains this year's particular die-off or not, it's got to be a long-term problem. And I'm on board with you. We need to do something about it. This episode is going to come out either late March or early April of 2025. What's it like in spring where you are as far as how you take care of your bees? Do they need a lot of food or what's going on right now?
Well, no, if I do everything right in fall, I don't have to do a whole lot in the spring. But there's often, you know, a hive here or there that for some reason have used more honey than I anticipated or expected. And so they might need some feeding. The best feed for our bees are honey in the comb. So I will take honey. The first thing I do is take honey from hives that have died over the winter, and if as long as they haven't died from disease that's contagious, I'll use that honey to feed my bees rather than feed them sugar syrup or high fructose corn syrup or God forbid or whatever, because that's just going to make them healthier. And so mostly it's just nowadays trying to guess when spring is. The weather patterns are shifting and changing, or the last 2 years I've gotten into my bees way earlier than ever before. Usually it was toward the end of April. Now it's last couple of years, it's been the beginning of April, first, second week of April, I've gotten into them. We'll see what happens this year.
I appreciate all of that info, and let's jump right into it. I want to learn more about apitherapy. You mentioned that you were mentored by someone that was really into this. Is that how you got into it, or did you learn in other ways?
No, that was my exposure through Charlie Mraz and going to some of the meetings of the American Apitherapy Society, which she was a founding member of, and just learning of it, or learning about it, having him teach me how to do it, reading his book on it, appreciating of all the gifts the bees provide, you know, that everything about a beehive is so healing, not just for the environment, but for humans as well. Literally everything. Honey, the propolis, which is the tree resins the bees gather and create the most powerful antimicrobial substance found in nature, pollen, royal jelly, and the bee venom, even the beeswax, everything has uses for healing and health. And so if you have access to a beehive, you got access to a cornucopia of healing and healthy materials and products that are affordable and will remain affordable because the pharmaceutical companies can't patent them and control their distribution and charge a ton of money for it. Anyone with a beehive can have access to these things. Unfortunately, that's part of the reason why there hasn't been, until more recent years, a huge amount of research into the effects of the bee products and their health healing properties, because there's just not a lot of money in it that can be controlled. For the masses, I think, you know, that's just a great, inexpensive, accessible source of health and healing products. And that's going to be especially important, I think, as we go forward here in the future. The way things seem to be going, we keep getting more and more chaotic weather, which is creating destabilization in society. And if for some reason you don't have access to health care when you need it, but you have access to a beehive, you could be saving your life or the life of loved ones or even just friends, neighbors, people in the who need help if you have access to a beehive and you're aware of what the properties of the bee products are.
Let's talk about some of these things individually. Let's start with propolis. We beekeepers know what it is. It can go anywhere from sticky to crunchy. What is the best way to harvest it, and what ways do you suggest that we use it, and for what?
The best way to harvest it, it depends, you know. It depends. There's always more than one approach. Because propolis it acts as an extension of the honeybee's immune system, I purposely do not harvest propolis from my hives intentionally, which would be to put some kind of a propolis trap in the hive, something that is
has holes in it, is rough surface or something, and allows air or light through. Maybe you put it up, replace your inner cover with it. And the bees will, because they use propolis as a building material as well as a way to sterilize the inside of the hive, they will fill those holes or that rough surface with propolis. Typically, people will use some kind of a plastic or nylon material that's easy to twist and bend after it's been frozen, because propolis, as you mentioned, very sticky when it's warm, but get hard and brittle when it's cold. So you would take that propolis trap after it's been filled with propolis, put it in the freezer, let it get hard, the propolis get hard and brittle, and then you take it out of the freezer and just kind of tweak the, bend the plastic or the mesh or whatever you use, and the propolis cracks and breaks off, and then you can reuse the trap. But myself, I only harvest the propolis that I come across in chunks when I'm harvesting my honey. So on the frames or in the supers, there's often propolis, and I will harvest that because I'm not really looking to take the propolis from the bees. They need it to be as healthy as possible. And that's possibly part of the problem. I mean, there's a lot of factors going into the current state of health of the bees and why they're suffering so much. And one of them is that over the years, beekeepers bred bees for those that didn't produce a lot of propolis because it's bee glue, you know, is one of the things the beekeepers call it, is a nickname for it, because it glues everything together and makes it hard to manipulate the frames and take things apart. And so beekeepers have preferred bees over the years that didn't produce much propolis. But now we've been learning, thanks to Mala Spivak and her work, a lot of the work that was done at the University of Minnesota, propolis is really important for healthy bees. And it's really important for healthy people in that regard. And that's why I do collect it, and then I'll use it and make, usually I'll make a tincture out of it. But you can also find it ground up in capsules, or you can just use it straight raw. Grape, a sore throat.
How do you tincture it? What's your recipe for a tincture?
I don't know if you're familiar with herbalism and stuff. Most herbalists will use like 80 proof alcohol, you know, like vodka or something, to soak their herbs in and remove the medicinal properties. But the propolis, because the majority of it are these tree resins that are very dense, 80 proof alcohol, which is 40% alcohol, is not enough to dissolve it. You actually need a minimum of 70% alcohol, or 130, 140 proof. But if I do it, I just get the pure grain alcohol, the, you know, 95, 100% alcohol, and I use that, and I prefer organic, so I avoid any chemical contaminants, and I get into it, and that, I find, makes the best propolis tincture.
So do you take just X amount of propolis, put it in a pint of this alcohol, let it sit for a couple of months? How do you do it?
Yeah, that's basically it. I'll fill up the jar most of the way with propolis and then pour in the alcohol and, you know, you let it sit for a minimum of 2 weeks, shake it once a day. And by the end of that, all the propolis is pretty much dissolved. There'll be some gunk along the bottom, which is usually the beeswax and other stuff that's in the propolis that the bees use when they create the propolis. And then you can pour off the propolis infused alcohol. That's one way. Other people, there's other ways of making it. There's a water, you know, a non-alcohol way of doing it, because some people have issues with alcohol or it's drawing to the skin or whatever. But I think, personally, I think the alcohol makes the best tincture, gets the most of the material out of the propolis and into the tincture, and it preserves it the best.
So what do you use it for personally? And I know we can't speak as medical advice here. We'll get in trouble, but what does Ross use it for?
I find when I have a sore throat, really great for just knocking it right out. I'll put a dropper full, let it coat my throat before I go to bed at night, and again in the morning, and usually within a couple of days, sore throat's gone. Very good for external, any kind of external infections and things, wounds. Or it, quite frankly, because I tend to be one that, as much as I appreciate the modern medical system, especially when it comes to physical things, I find that they have a real challenge when it comes to any degenerative diseases. They haven't really figured that stuff out. And so I'll turn to a lot of, I might do what the doctor recommends, but I'll also do my own more natural supplements and food products and herbal flocks and propolis whenever I'm dealing with any kind of viral infection, bacterial infection, or anything like that, fungal. I will often take propolis as part of the protocol.
Let me just take a minute here to thank our presenting sponsor, Man Lake. One of the things I love about Man Lake is their commitment to education, because that commitment shows how much they want you to be successful at beekeeping. One great resource is their mobile app. You know, it's not just for shopping. It's packed full of all kinds of helpful information, including videos, articles, plus a plant identification feature designed to help beekeepers identify and plant bee-healthy plants for their area. It's free, so download the Man Lake app today. And speaking of shopping, don't forget your discount code, MLBLOVE10, it's in the show notes, for $10 off your first $100 purchase. Now, back to the guest.
Numbing areas. In fact, because our glaciers are melting at such a rapid pace, there was a recent discovery of they called him the Iceman, some guy that had died hundreds of years ago, frozen in ice, finally got uncovered as the glaciers receded. And when they studied his body, they found dental problems in his teeth, and he had stuffed propolis and beeswax in the cavities to fill the areas that had opened up in his teeth. Propolis had been used as kind of a dental approach to helping deal with dental issues. Propolis has been used for a long, long time. There has been studies that recommend more modern studies that indicate that it could be beneficial even today.
So internally or topically, it sounds like you can use it.
Yep. Yeah, it's very rare for anyone to have an allergic reaction to propolis. But if you do, usually it's just, you know, you have some skin reaction and you just cut back the propolis and the skin clears up. It's pretty darn safe, as far as I know.
Let's jump around. Tell me more about royal jelly and how people use it.
Well, royal jelly is kind of a milky substance that the bees produce in glands in their bodies that they feed to all the young bees when they're first hatched from the egg. All the larva gets royal jelly for the first 3 days or so. And then after that, the worker bees, the female worker bees and the male drones, they get switched over to a mix of the royal jelly with some honey and pollen mixed in. But the queen bee, she only gets royal jelly fed to her whole life, which is tend to be why they call it royal jelly. Unfortunately, to get royal jelly, you have to remove the queen from the hive. So it's pretty stressful on a colony to produce royal jelly. It's also basically very labor intensive. This is why most, if pretty much not all, of the royal jelly available on the market comes from China, because that's the only place where they can basically pay people hardly anything to produce this royal jelly. Because basically what happens is in each queen cell that the bee, when you remove the queen from the hive, the bees start building new queen cells to start raising new queens to try to replace her, and they deposit in a glob of royal jelly in every one of those wax cells to feed the developing larva. And then before that wax cell gets capped for the larva to go through its pupation to develop into a fully mature queen bee, you have to go in with, like, usually they use a little suction device to suck up all those little globs of royal jelly. So it's very, very labor intensive and kind of stressful and hard on the bees. But it does have apparently a lot of pretty powerful medicinal benefits. One of the primary differences between a worker bee that can live for maybe 5, 6, 8 weeks during the summer at best, and a queen bee that typically should be able to live 4 or 5 years. And that diet makes the difference. And this is powerful bee food. You know, it comes from the bee's body. It's got all kinds of bee hormones and enzymes and lots of bee vitamins and protein, and has its own antiviral, antifungal properties. Way back in the older days, in Asia, the emperors were given royal jelly because it was believed, like after observing the queen bees in the hive,
that it would help the emperor to not only live long, but be sexually virile and vibrant in his old age, to help keep the genetic family line going. Personally, I don't use royal jelly a whole lot just because it is so stressful to the beehives.
All right. We're going in no particular order. I'll give you a heads up, Ross, though. I want to save bee venom for last. That's something I'm super interested in. Let's talk about pollen next.
Pollen is considered a superfood because it's so packed with vitamins and protein and minerals. The pollen that the plants produce in the area around the hive, the bees gather it up as they fly through the air. They actually build up a static electric charge on their bodies, so the pollen grains will stick to them, kind of like a balloon sticking to the wall after you rub it on your hair. And the bees will, they actually have a kind of a comb-like hairs on their legs that they can use to groom themselves and comb that pollen into a little ball that they carry on their hind legs back to the hive, and that is the primary source for all their fats, protein, vitamins, and minerals. They actually will ferment that pollen by adding a little bit of nectar or honey to it. In the honey or nectar is this beneficial bacteria, and when they add it to the pollen, it mixes with the pollen and will cause the pollen to ferment after it's been placed in the cells for storage. And that's for long-term storage, because pollen is actually highly degradable. It's perishable. And so the bees know that you ferment it is a way of storing it for long-term use, like, for example, during the winter, when they have no access to the pollen outside.
And for people to use, there are various, pollen traps that beekeepers can get, put in a hive, collect some pollen. Would you tell us two things? One, how do people make sure they're being careful not to collect too much pollen so that it's hurting the colony? And then two, how do people use pollen and what for?
So yeah, that's a good point. You know, if you take too much pollen from the hive, that's going to harm them because that's their primary source of food for the young. They primarily use pollen to feed and raise the young bees. And when you have a hive that's, you know, could be raising over 1,000 new bees every day during the peak of the summer, that's a lot of pollen that gets used.
How do we know that we're not taking too much? Should we put a pollen trap in maybe one day a week and take it out, or what would be safe?
Yeah, something like that. You know, one or two, 3 days at the most, but then take it out so they get some in. Sometimes the bees figure it out on their own. I've seen bees that you had a pollen trap on the hive, and then the bees started gathering smaller pellets of pollen on their legs that they could slip through the trap and get it in, because the way a pollen trap works, basically it creates an opening that's so small at the entrance of the hive, the bees kind of have to squeeze through it to get in, and it knocks the pollen off their hind legs, and that falls through a screen where you can collect it in a tray. And the bees have learned to gather just enough so they can squeeze through and still get the pollen into the hive. With any other openings than where the pollen trap is, they'll use that opening to get the pollen into the hive. If the bees aren't able to figure it out, the beekeeper needs to definitely assist them and make sure that the trap isn't on full time and that it's taken off with enough guns and with enough space and in period of time to allow the bees to bring in the food that they're going to need to feed their young and keep developing the colony through the season as they need to.
Yeah, that is super important. Okay, health-wise, what do you use it for?
Well, it's just it's a super food. It's got actually better, higher quality protein, some pollens, than beef, quite literally. So it is pretty powerful. It kind of depends, though. You got to remember, pollen, it's being gathered from the flowers in the area. So much of the quality of the pollen is going to depend on where the bees have been foraging and what flowers they've been visiting. But basically, it's just powerful nutrition. Any kind of issues you have with nutritional deficiency, the source of the problem, pollen has the potential to help alleviate that because it is such a powerful, nutrient-dense food.
Can it help with allergies like honey can?
Interestingly enough, a lot of people have found that it does.
it's based on this basic idea that immunization shots are based on. Well, you get exposed to something, and if it doesn't kill you, right, then your body builds up an immunity to it. And so that's the idea when it comes to pollen. A lot of times, beekeepers will, or you hear that it's raw honey that you should eat. But that's just a way to sell more honey. The reality is raw honey is not filtered or heated, so it's still going to have the pollen in it. A little bit of the pollen from the flowers that the bees gather the nectar from to create the honey. There's going to be some pollen that gets in there. And that is, if you have an allergy to that pollen, but you consume very small amounts of it, it can actually help your body to build up immunity so you don't get those kind of hay fever symptoms as often people experience in spring or fall. It's not really the raw honey that's doing it, it's the pollen. And so the best, perhaps, treatment, if you will, or approach, you'd want to get pollen from the plants that you are allergic to, whether it's goldenrod or dandelions or whatever. And then there is a protocol that's been established through the American Apiatherapy Society where you take, one half of one of those little pollen balls that has been collected from the bees that you can buy in like health food stores or whatever. And you eat that one day. And then the next day, as long as you're not getting a bad reaction or something, maybe you'll eat one whole pollen ball. And then the next day after that, you double it. So then you have two. And then the next day you have four. And then the next day, 8, and then 16, and then maybe a quarter teaspoon, and half a teaspoon, and a full teaspoon. And usually after that, 10 or 14 days of taking the pollen like that, people find they don't have the kind of reactions that they normally would have.
So the first thing that got me interested in beekeeping years ago was for this purpose, for seasonal allergies. And I had read a lot about it, and I didn't know much, but just what I had read and the advice was have some kind of an amount that you take every day, a teaspoon or whatever, of raw honey from your area. So I went out, bought some raw honey from a beekeeper that's about 150 miles away from where I live, but relatively similar terrain and vegetation and that kind of stuff. Now, I don't know if that beekeeper filtered their honey or not. All I know is I set up my own protocol. I took a little honey every day for months. Here came spring and I was just as bad as usual. And I just said, okay, well, this doesn't work. Until I read that this really is a hyper-local kind of thing. And since I have had my own beehives on my own property and I do that, and my allergies are significantly better now. They're not gone, but they are way, way better than they used to be.
Well, that's an interesting experience because personally, I'm not so sure it needs to be that hyper-local. In theory, if the honey is gathered, where the nectar is gathered to make the honey from flowers that you have allergies to, it should work. Whether those flowers are in your backyard or 150, 350 miles away. In the general area or region.
And I don't know if they were the same flowers or if that honey was being sifted. For some reason, it didn't work for me.
Sure, that's part of it. And that's part of the problem in beekeeping and the marketplace. There is little to no policing of label claims. So people can, there's no definition from the government on what raw honey actually is. And I know for a fact there are beekeepers out there that heat their honey and they filter it and they put raw on the label. And no one questions it or consumers don't know the difference. To me, an egg that is soft boiled is not raw. It's been exposed to heat. It's no longer raw. It's not, hard boiled. It's not fully cooked, but it's not raw. And to me, the same thing with honey. Beekeepers, they only heat it to 120 degrees or it's only 160 degrees for a short period of time or whatever. To me, that's not raw honey. Raw honey is period, no heat added other than room temperature, basically, or high temperature.
You're preaching to the choir here. I couldn't agree with you more. And there's also the term organic, which I see a lot of people put on their honey. And I know where their hives are, and there's no way they can guarantee that that's organic.
Well, that's interesting because, you know, organic is a federally regulated term. And you're not legally, you're not supposed to put organic and call your honey organic unless you meet specific criteria and have been inspected by a third party to confirm the organic nature of your operation. And so if you actually are seeing that, you can report that to the regional organic certifier who will correct that inappropriate marketing and labeling.
And I just think it's a matter of not knowing and understanding that. I mean, go to your local farmer's market. Chances are you're going to see a beekeeper that's done that, and they just don't know any better. I don't think they're trying to be colluding in some big scheme or something or other. What else can you tell us about honey besides allergies? Internally, topically, what should we use honey for?
Oh my gosh. What do you not use honey for?
Yeah, exactly.
It's the first aid kit in a jar, quite literally.
Let's talk about burns and cuts, things like that.
Yeah. Well, you see, honey is a unique substance, even though there are people now trying, because the honey bees are dying at such large numbers every year, people are worried. And so there's people that have started creating synthetic honey, not real honey, but it's honey-like. But honey is unique in that it is, first of all, you know, it's got a pH level because of the sugars that inhibits the growth of bacteria and things. I mean, we've been using sugar to preserve jams and jellies, for example, for eons, right? But honey goes much farther than that because honey is hygroscopic. That means the bees have removed so much moisture from that honey, so it's down to usually below 18% moisture content, that the honey wants to draw moisture to itself. So actually, if you leave a jar of honey with the lid off just on your kitchen table for a week or two, it can draw enough humidity out of the air to significantly raise the moisture level of the honey in that jar. But when honey is fully ripened by bees with a moisture level below about 18%, then nothing harmful to humans can grow in that honey. Because what happens is that honey, it wants to attract moisture to itself. So any bacteria, for example, that gets into that honey, the honey will suck the moisture out of it and destroy it and kill it, desiccate it. Honey also, if it's raw honey and hasn't been heated, it contains still the enzymes that the bees put into that honey when they created it. Heat destroys enzymes. But if it hasn't been heated and it's raw, one of the enzymes is glucose oxidase, which when that breaks down on your skin, forms a number of compounds, including hydrogen peroxide. So if you have a cut or a wound and you put honey on it, it will release this small amounts of hydrogen peroxide continually as it breaks down. So it's sterilizing the wound. It's sucking the moisture out of any bacteria it comes in contact with. And it's just amazing, really, for healing of exterior wounds. And I know for myself, whenever I get a cut or something and I don't really take care of it properly and starts to get red and infected, I put a little bob of raw honey on it at night before I go to bed and cover it with a Band-Aid or a piece of gauze or something. And when I wake up in the morning, when I take that Band-Aid or gauze off, every time I've done it, the red is gone. It's gotten rid of the infection. And in fact, it's so powerful for healing that in most countries, not so much here in the United States, but because, like I said, we're all about money here. You can't patent natural things like honey. But in most countries, the preferred healing modality for burns, as you had mentioned, is honey. It just is superior to the Silverdyne ointment or whatever it is that most hospitals here in the U.S. use. Because not only does it prevent the site from getting infected, but it keeps the wound moist and it actually feeds the cells so they can grow back faster. And it's a lot more humane, quite frankly. The modern-day version of the silver-impregnated
ointment that they typically put on burn victims here in the U.S. It has to be scraped off each day and reapplied. And that's an incredibly painful process. With honey, you put it on and it just absorbs in and breaks down naturally. There's no scraping off. The next day, you simply lift up the wound dressing and you apply the new honey and you cover it back up. It works so much better also because they find that when treated with honey, the typical discoloration of the skin that occurs with burn victims is much lessened. In many cases, there is no discoloration. It just heals so much better. It's just astounding. It really is. But unfortunately, it's not a big moneymaker, which is why it's not really promoted and used as much as it really should be, in my view.
Is there such a thing as medical-grade honey, or can I take honey right out of my hive and put it on a burn?
Well, there is medical-grade honey. Because of all the research that was being done and the experience in other countries, here in the U.S., the Food and Drug Administration finally, after many years, approved one certain type of honey to be used for it's called Medi-Honey, and you can get it now in hospitals. If they have it, then you probably have to ask for it. But it is from the Manuka plant, which is primarily in New Zealand and Australia. And it's been, you know, highly purified and irradiated to kill any germs or virus. You know, it's like it's been treated to be medically acceptable. But as you kind of pointed out, really any honey that is raw, unheated and unfiltered will work just about as well. It doesn't have to be this $35 an ounce honey that the medical establishment uses. Your honey from your hive will work quite well as well. It may not work as perfect, but it will work most likely adequately and sufficiently for your use.
Thank you. Great explanation. Okay, we've talked about using honey topically. How about internally? What kinds of things can it help us with?
Well, one of the reasons why this Medi-Honey was approved is because this Manuka honey actually, in studies, was the most effective at killing the bacteria that causes ulcers. And so that's why it got accepted. But so, yeah, there's a bunch of different uses. It can help with sleep issues. It can help with weight issues. It helps really great with sore throats. In fact, one study that compared it to over-the-counter cough syrups, for example, with kids. The kids liked the honey better. It was less expensive, and it worked better than the over-the-counter stuff. So, yeah, there's all kinds of, I mean, I can't get into all the stuff, but really the American Apitherapy Society will be the place to go if you or your listeners wanted to learn more. They're just a clearinghouse for information on the use of honeybee products for healing and health. AAS, you can find them online, really cheap to become a member. And if you become a member, you get access to their international list of apitherapists all over the world, people who are using bee products to help promote healing and health. You can get help, like, for example, if you wanted to get bee stings, for example, you could find sources for bees. You could find maybe people that will apply the bee stings for you, that type of thing.
We'll put a link to their website in the show notes so that people can find it easily. All right, lastly, since you just brought up bee stings, let's talk venom. What can you get us started on with bee venom?
Well, that's the business end of the honeybee, right?
Yep.
Bees use the venom to try to discourage predators, right? When a bee stings you, it actually, unlike all the other stinging insects, a honeybee will die. The honeybee stinger is barbed like an arrow. So, and because your skin is stretchy, if you get stung by a bee, that stinger tends to get caught in your skin. A bee will pull so hard to try to remove the stinger, it'll rip out its entrails, and within a fairly short period of time, it will die. So it's not in the honeybee's interest to go around stinging people for no reason, right? First of all, people need to know they're only going to sting if they feel threatened. If you are really close to the hive or disturbing their hive, if you are swatting at them or something, it may feel personally like you're trying to, you know, you step on them or something, then they'll sting you. But normally, honeybees They're really gentle creatures. They're not looking for problems and trouble, and they're not going to bother people.
What are people using bee venom for?
Primarily for things like rheumatoid diseases, like arthritis, and for multiple sclerosis. Can help with shingles, things like that. All these rheumatoid type diseases seems to be very effective. And there's some certain types of cancers that have been helped with bee venom. This is all kind of experimental, if you will. It's not, there's no standard protocols that are approved. And all these products, they're natural products. Like I said, they're not patented or anything. And mostly what they all do is they're about building up the body's immune system so the body can heal itself. I think any physician or health practitioner, if they're honest, they'll tell you they don't heal people. They try to create the environment where the body can then do the healing that it needs to do to deal with the situation. And that's what apitherapy is about, building up the body's immune response so it can start to heal itself and help the body to heal. Is it the body that does the healing, not the treatment real ultimately, right? You just want to create the environment for the body to be able to do that, what it needs to do.
I saw recently an article from, I forget which country in Europe, where they had set up a thing where people were breathing hive air. They had like a tube that went into the hive and a little face mask on the other end, and you could sit there and just breathe hive air. Have you ever heard of that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, this is a kind of a newer thing. There are even like beds that are above the hive, and then all the air feeds into this little room or kind of that you crawl into, and you can sleep there and get exposed to the smell of the hive, basically. And, you know, it's got the aromatic compounds from the propolis, and primarily that's probably the biggest part of it. And it can apparently help with certain things and certain conditions. In getting back to the bee venom, if I may.
Yes, please.
I just want to explain a little bit about how it seems to work. When you get stung with a bee, you know, it kind of hurts. That always is the case. So typically what you want to do if you're getting bee stings for therapeutic purposes, you want to put some ice or something frozen on the area that you're going to sting ahead of time so that it kind of numbs the area, and that way the bee sting itself doesn't hurt as much. And then when you do get stung, of course, all the blood rushes to the area, which is why often you get swelling, is because, you know, like with any treatment, any kind of medical treatment, there's side effects. With bee stings, or swelling, itchy, redness, might be sore and painful, that type of thing. And the reason you get the swelling, of course, is because all the blood is rushing to that area. And that, though, is bringing the healing properties that are in your blood to focus on the area that you've stung. And those areas tend to be the areas that hurt the most, is typically how Charlie Maz would do it, which he explains in his book, Help and the Honeybee, I think it's called. Basically, he would press all around the joint is bothering a person and find the places that hurt the most, and with a pen, you know, just a little dot on that spot, so he knew where to apply the sting. And you apply the ice to it first to numb it, and then he would reach into a jar that he collected some bees in with a pair of forceps and grab the bee and touch the tip of the abdomen to that spot, so the bee would deposit its stinger in the skin and then leave it there for a good, you know, 10 minutes or so to allow all the venom to be deposited into the site. And one of the things that researchers have found is that the bee venom stimulates the body's production of cortisol. And cortisol is the natural version of cortisone, which is the drug that's patented and provided to people who have pain from arthritis, for example. It helps to relieve that pain. Well, cortisol does that naturally. That's the body's version. The problem is the cortisone shot that you get, that chemical is not exactly the same formulation as the cortisol that your body produces. And when you get lots of these cortisone shots over a long period of time, it can cause real bad problems with the liver, and it could potentially kill you after a long period of time. But you don't get those kind of side effects with the cortisol that your body produces, because it is totally
in harmony with your body. Your body made it. It's meant to be there. The production of cortisol by the body, though, has been found to require lack of vitamin C and B vitamins. And so people that are going to be using bee stings for healing, especially pain treatment, try to reduce pain symptoms, it's a good idea to be taking 1 to 2,000 milligrams of vitamin C and a multi-B complex, has all the B vitamins in it. Take one of those about an hour or so before you get stung so that your body has all the raw materials it needs to produce the maximum amount of cortisol so you can get the best benefit.
Okay, I just learned two things because I've tried this a little bit. First of all, I thought you had to go for the full pain, and I haven't done the ice cube thing, which seems like a super good idea. And second is the B and C vitamins, so thank you for that.
There's a lot more to it, too, which is why I recommend people get in touch with the American Apitherapy Society. You know, you got to take basic precautions. It's a good idea to have an EpiPen on hand because even though it's a true life-threatening allergy, hyperallergic response to bee venom is very rare in the population. It could potentially happen. It's good to have an idea, have a epinephrine injector pen handy in case you go in anaphylactic shock, which is a potential side effect from getting bee stings. But also, because of the swelling that's involved, if you're going to sting your hands or something, remove your jewelry first. Take off your rings. Don't wear those things because if your fingers swell up and that ring is constricting, it could cut off the blood supply and cause problems. Common sense.
Sorry to laugh. Such good advice there. Thank you, Ross. Hey, we're running out of time. Any last thoughts on this whole topic before I let you go?
Well, as I said in the beginning, everything from the beehive is so incredibly healing for the world. And that's why I'm really distressed at how bad the honeybees are suffering these days and how difficult it is and how much of a challenge beekeepers are having trying to keep the bees alive. We're not being the kind of stewards to this incredible world that we've inherited, that we should be. One of the things that I've learned from the bees is that it takes, they estimate, a honeybee working its entire life gathering nectar to produce honey can produce about 1/12 of a teaspoon of honey. Okay, so 12 bees working their whole lifetime can produce 1 teaspoon of honey that you get to enjoy in your coffee or your tea. But yet, to get through an entire year, such as in a cold place, especially like Vermont, the bees need 150 to 200 pounds of honey. And yet the bee itself can only gather 1/12 of a teaspoon. That it seems so insignificant. And yet the honeybee doesn't fall for the illusion that what they do is insignificant, right? The bee's going to do what it can do, and it counts on all its other hive mates to do what they can do, and together they can make miracles happen, hundreds of pounds of honey. And so when people look at the challenges that we are being faced with today in all so many different areas, from the climate and the environment and the economic system and our government system and healthcare and energy and education and everything, often it can feel overwhelming. But the reality is everything you do can have an effect. Be a power of one person can make a difference, especially when it's combined with millions, if not billions, of other people's efforts. And so that gives me a lot of inspiration to not give up and to do what I can every day and do it now. The time has come for us to all start doing what we know needs to be done and stop putting things off or thinking someone else is going to take care of things. We need to start taking action ourselves to create the world we want and be the change we want to see. So thank you, Eric, for doing what you do.
You've just brought up so many things that we love about honeybees, and that's what this show is all about. And thank you very much, Ross. I appreciate your time.
Hey, you're welcome. Take care.
Thanks again for joining us here on Bee Love Beekeeping, presented by Mann Lake. Another great place for more information on everything related to this podcast is in our email newsletter. You can sign up for it for free at beelovebeekeeping.com. And remember, if you're not just in it for the honey or the money, you're in it for the love. See you next week.